The composition of the Grand Committee to resolve the deadlock between the Virginia and New Jersey plans for a national government could not have offered much consolation to either James Madison or James Wilson, fixed as they were on the proposal for a two-house Congress, both houses popularly elected by the people at large rather than chosen by the state legislatures. Each state delegation in the assembly room was to contribute one member to the Grand Committee, and it all leaned in the opposite direction from Madison and Wilson. The committee was composed of Abraham Baldwin from Georgia, William Patterson from New Jersey, Luther Martin, Patterson's Maryland ally, and the utterly uncooperative Robert Yates from New York. In fact, both Madison and Wilson themselves were passed over for membership on the committee. George Mason was selected to represent Virginia, and doddering old Benjamin Franklin would sit for Pennsylvania, despite Madison's suspicion that Dr. Franklin was understood to be partial to a single house of legislation. And rounding out the Grand Committee would be Roger Sherman for Connecticut, William Davey of North Carolina, John Rutledge of South Carolina, and the committee's chairman, Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, none of them having said a word in support of Madison and Wilson. They set to work as soon as the convention adjourned on July 2nd, meeting for dinner at Franklin's house on Market Street that evening, and then meeting again the next day in the State House. The atmosphere was tense. Luther Martin later said that they were on the verge of dissolution, scarce held together by the strength of an hair. Gerry, the chair of the Grand Committee, thought the moment was so serious as to threaten a dissolution of the convention. But the wily old leather apron printer turned out to be far less doddering in committee than he appeared on the convention's floor, and he pressed on the Grand Committee a series of formulas which he believed would placate both the Madisonian big staters and the Pattersonian small staters. And it ran like this. First, let there be two houses to the National Congress. Then, let the lower house, the House of Representatives, be elected by the population at large, so that, yes, the large states like Virginia and Pennsylvania would have a disproportionately large representation over against the small states. And let one representative be elected to this house for every 40,000 inhabitants. Carefully, Franklin did not specify what he meant by an inhabitant. That would be a problem for another day. Then let the upper house, the Senate, be the place where each state, regardless of size, would be represented equally. George Mason of Virginia was aware that his fellow big staters would choke on this notion, so Mason sweetened it with the concession he himself had written for the Virginia state constitution. Let all the legislation concerning money and taxation be the domain of the House of Representatives, and all bills for apportioning and spending money originate there rather than the Senate. Outside in the streets of Philadelphia, the weather was approaching the hottest it had been since the beginning of the summer. The 4th of July was celebrated with bell ringing, artillery salutes, and fireworks. The eateries of the city, the City Tavern, Gray's Ferry, Fish House, Wigwam, Gaifa's, and Lilliput on the Jersey Shore, were crowded with different parties from this city and Jersey who met with mutual congratulations and spent the remainder of the day with liberality and good humor which always mark and characterize the Sons of Freedom on this glorious festival. The Society of the Cincinnati held a parade with accompaniments of music from martial instruments from the State House to the German Reformed Church on Race Street, where an orator held forth on the advantages which have resulted to mankind from the independence of America. But none of the festivities could quite dampen the undercurrent of anxiety people were feeling at the lack of news from a convention which now seemed to be dragging on at suspicious length. These anxieties took a sharper edge from the fact that Elbridge Gerry, as the chair of the Grand Committee, would be making its report when the convention reassembled on July 5th. A spare, thin, sunken-cheeked merchant from Marblehead who looked vastly older than his nearly 43 years, Gerry had graduated from Harvard in 1762, went into the family business, then into politics, and was elected to the Second Continental Congress, where he signed the Declaration of Independence. He was, by temperament, suspicious. One contemporary wrote that Gerry was habitually suspicious, accustomed in the early period of his life to watch with a jealous eye the actions and opinions of those who administered the government, to anticipate evil, even for ostensible good, and to calculate on coming danger before even its shadow could be seen. He acquired an indisposition to give his confidence easily, readily, or freely. What aggravated this deficit was these limitations as a speaker in a convention where oratorical skills were vital. He is far from being distinguished for his talents in oratory, wrote Charles Thompson, the Confederation Congress's secretary. He was anything but. In fact, Gerry suffered with an uncouth delivery, broken and interrupted with many a heck and hem and repetition of ofs and ands, which is to say that he stuttered. The observant William Pierce admitted that Mr. Gerry's character is marked for integrity and perseverance, but he is a hesitating and laboring speaker, and only sometimes clear in his arguments. Gerry was clear enough, though, when on the morning of July 5th he made the report of the Grand Committee. And the report went like this. First, that in the first branch of the legislature, the House of Representatives, each of the states now in the Union shall be allowed one member for every 40,000 inhabitants, and that each state not containing that number shall be allowed one member. That all bills for raising or appropriating money and for fixing the salaries of the officers of the government of the United States shall originate in the first branch of the legislature and shall not be altered or amended by the second branch. And that no money shall be drawn from the public treasury but in pursuance of appropriations to be originated in the first branch. Second, that in the second branch, the Senate, each state shall have an equal vote. And Gerry was candid enough to add that the Grand Committee had agreed to the report merely in order that some ground of accommodation might be proposed, and that those opposed to the equality of votes have only assented conditionally. That, however, was enough to set off Wilson and Madison. Wilson accused the Grand Committee of having exceeded their powers. Madison was furious. The convention, he said, was reduced to the alternative of either departing from justice, which is what he now insisted proportional representation in Congress to consist of, in order to conciliate the smaller states, or of displeasing these by justly gratifying the larger states and the majority of the people. Making concessions like this to the small staters was merely to perpetuate the problems which had brought them all to the convention in the first place. It was in vain, Madison warned, to purchase concord in the convention on terms which would perpetuate discord among their constituents. Do not be deceived, Madison warned, by threats from the small staters to break up the union. He could not suspect that Delaware would brave the consequences of seeking her fortunes apart from the other states rather than submit to such a government, much less could he suspect that she would pursue the rash policy of courting foreign support, which the warmth of one of her representatives, he meant Gunning Bedford, had suggested or if she should, that any foreign nation would be so rash as to hearken to the overture. But Gary, in fact, defended the bargain precisely because it was a bargain, and the only bargain that would keep all the states together. If no compromise should take place, what will be the consequence? Gary asked. A secession, he foresaw, would take place, for some gentlemen seemed decided on it. In that case, the American Republic would fall apart and become easy prey to the empires all around them. If we do not come to some agreement among ourselves, Gary said, some foreign sword will probably do the work for us. And George Mason chimed in weightily. There must be some accommodation on this point, Mason argued. However liable the report might be to objections, he thought it preferable to an appeal to the world by the different sides, as has been talked of by some gentlemen. It could not be more inconvenient to any gentleman to remain absent from his private affairs than it was for him, but he would bury his bones in this city rather than expose his country to the consequences of a dissolution of the convention without anything being done. If there was any one moment in the breadth of the Constitutional Convention's proceedings when it felt that something tectonic was shifting under the feet of the delegates, when a point of no return had been met and passed, it was surely here with George Mason's declaration. He was a Virginian. He had been part of the first meetings which led to this convention. He was the intimate friend of Washington, who maintained his impartial silence from the president's chair. Whatever disappointment compromise spelled from Madison, from this moment on, there was no more serious debate on whether there should be one or two houses, or whether they should be elected by the general population or by the states. The question would now become merely a matter of arranging the details of the Grand Committee's report. Although the final vote would not be taken on the Grand Committee's recommendations until July 16th, the first great battle of the convention was really over. But to use the word merely, as in merely arranging the details of the Grand Committee's recommendations, that may be the wrong word to use about arranging the details of how the House of Representatives and the Senate were to be elected. Franklin's idea had fixed on having one representative in the lower house for every 40,000 inhabitants. But Gouverneur Morris was ready with an objection on July 6th. If 40,000 was the baseline for allocating a representative, then Morris's Pennsylvania would probably get 8, although determining this was, as he admitted, little more than a guess. Virginia's westernmost province of Kentucky was already making motions about setting itself up as a separate state. So was the province of Maine, which was technically still a part of Massachusetts. Their populations were bound to be far below 40,000. But according to the compromise, they would still be entitled to one representative, at least, in the House of Representatives. This, by Gouverneur Morris's logic, cheated Pennsylvania and the other existing states, since 40,000 of their inhabitants got them only one representative, while 3,000 or 4,000 in Maine or Kentucky would also get them one representative. Hence, 3,000 or 4,000 Kentuckians would get more of a say in Congress than any 3,000 or 4,000 Pennsylvanians or Virginians. Other objections crowded in as well. How exactly should the states be represented in the Senate? Back in June, Roger Sherman of Connecticut had insisted that in the second branch, or Senate, each state should have one vote and no more. It was neither here nor there to Sherman whether the states were represented in the Senate by multiple senators. When it came to a vote, only one vote should be cast for each state. If they vote by states in the second branch, and each state has an equal vote, Sherman argued, there must always be a majority of states as well as a majority of the people on the side of public measures, and the government will have decision and efficacy. But neither Sherman nor Luther Martin, who spoke bluntly in favor of voting by states in the Senate and against voting per capita, with each senator voting as they saw fit, as departing from the idea of the states being represented in the second branch, could carry the day. And eventually, the convention settled on allowing each state two senators, each of whom would be permitted to vote independently. What proved infinitely more contentious was the injection of the idea of reckoning property into the formula for determining representation in the lower house. Because any discussion of property led ineluctably to a subject almost everyone in the convention would sooner have ignored: slavery. By the best calculations we have, the United States was home in 1787 to about 800,000 Africans, most of them enslaved, as the human property of their owners. In fact, African Americans would make up a higher percentage of the American population, about 21%, than they ever would at any later time in American history. It was a population heavily skewed toward the southern states. Almost half of South Carolina's population was black, and so was 40% of Virginia's. Yet slavery was by no means a robust institution in the United States. One reason for its lack of health lay in how squarely it cut across the political philosophy of the Enlightenment. All men are originally equal, wrote the Scottish philosopher Francis Hutcheson, because every human being is born with the same set of natural rights. And that set, Hutcheson listed as including a right to life, a right to preserve one's chastity, a right to an unblemished character, a right of liberty, a right over life, so that each one, as Hutcheson said, in any honorable services to society or his friends, may expose himself not only to dangers, but to certain death when such public good is in view, and a right of private judgment, or of judging for himself in all matters of duty, especially as to religion. On that basis, Hutcheson concluded, nature makes none masters, none slaves. The American Declaration of Independence fixed that principle in its opening paragraph. So did the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which George Mason had drafted. All men are by nature equally free and independent, wrote Mason, and have certain inherent rights of which, when they enter into a state of society, they cannot, by any compact, deprive or divest their posterity, namely, the enjoyment of life and liberty with the means of acquiring and possessing property and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. And if those words sound familiar, if in fact they sound like a parallel to the Declaration of Independence, well, remember the kind of influence George Mason had on his fellow Virginians, and especially that Virginian from the Piedmont, Thomas Jefferson. The other reason for slavery's less than perfect health was pure economics. Slave labor was introduced into the Chesapeake in the 17th century largely as a labor mechanism for growing tobacco, which was a very labor-intensive agricultural product. And many were the Virginia and Maryland fortunes which had been built on the back of it. But tobacco, as a profitable cash crop, had long been in trouble. It reached a productive high point in the 1770s when 100 million pounds of tobacco were exported to Great Britain from the Chesapeake. But the price had been in steep decline from its 17th century highs, and with only a disappointingly modest recovery in the years just after the Revolution. Another slave-grown crop, rice, flourished in the Carolina lowlands in the 1700s, with production rising from 1710 till 1770 from 1 million to almost 100 million pounds of rice. But the price there, too, had gone flat in the 1770s, and per capita exports of rice peaked as early as 1740. Meanwhile, ordinary grain crops, which did not require the labor intensity of tobacco or rice, were taking off. Grain exports from the Upper South swelled between 1768 and 1772 from 10,000 pounds per year to 199,000 pounds per year. As population increases, observed Oliver Ellsworth at the convention, poor laborers will be so plenty as to render slaves useless. Slavery might be necessary for growing tobacco and rice because it was so labor-intensive, but now these were ceasing to be the great cash crops. As ordinary grains took their place, they were much less labor-intensive, much more something that could be raised by single farmers on comparatively small patches of ground. There would be, long-term, no need for slave labor. Ellsworth said, slavery in time will not be a speck in our country. Provision is already made in Connecticut for abolishing it, and the abolition has already taken place in Massachusetts. In fact, every southern state except Georgia had begun restraining the slave trade. Emancipation restrictions in Maryland and Virginia were loosened. It really did seem as though Ellsworth was right, and that the sleeping dog might be allowed simply to lie. But not if slaves were going to be counted among the population, which determined each state's number of representatives. For small states like New Jersey and Delaware, adding slaves, either in terms of their value as property or simply as noses to be counted in a census, would create even more of an imbalance in the lower house. On July 6th, a 5-member panel was created to specify how many representatives each state would receive based on the 40,000 per representative rule. The panel reported back on July 9th, describing a House of Representatives to be composed of 56 representatives. Virginia would get 9. Pennsylvania, 8. Massachusetts, 7. New York, North Carolina, and South Carolina, each 5. Connecticut and Maryland, each 4. New Hampshire and Georgia, 2. Rhode Island and Delaware, 1. Now, this struck Roger Sherman as odd. It did not appear to correspond with any rule of numbers he was familiar with, and he quizzed them hard for the basis of their calculations. Nathaniel Gorham vaguely replied to Sherman's prodding inquiry that the number of blacks and whites with some regard to supposed wealth was the general guide. But that set William Patterson off like a rocket, who could only imagine the Virginians stacking their representation in Congress on the basis of counting black slaves and free whites equally to earn their representatives. This despite the fact that black slaves had no say in the actual politics of Virginia. Patterson could regard Negro slaves in no light but as property. They are no free agents, have no personal liberty, no faculty of acquiring property, but on the contrary, are property themselves, and like other property, entirely at the will of the master. No one counted slaves as the basis for representation in the Virginia legislature. Why here? Patterson asked. Has a man in Virginia a number of votes in proportion to the number of his slaves? And if Negroes are not represented in the states to which they belong, why should they be represented in the general government? What this really came down to, Patterson suspected, was an indirect encouragement of the slave trade. But Patterson's assault on including slaves in the formula for determining representation stung the slaveholders in the convention, and especially those from the South. And on July 12, William Davey of North Carolina had had enough. It was high time now to speak out, Davey announced. He saw that it was meant by some gentlemen to deprive the Southern states of any share of representation for their blacks. And if that was their intention, he could assure them that North Carolina would never confederate on any terms that did not rate them, meaning black slaves, at least as 3/5. If the Eastern states meant, therefore, to exclude them altogether, the business was at an end. 3/5 was the formula which had been used under the Articles of Confederation for assessing contributions from the states. And no one less than Edmund Randolph rose to support Davy. Randolph was not pleased at the interjection of this discussion into the debates of the convention because he lamented that such a species of property existed. But existed did. And any design to ignore it would be construed as a plan by some of excluding slaves altogether. Again, tempers mounted. And Gouverneur Morris frankly declared that the people of Pennsylvania will never agree to a representation of Negroes as slaves by any fifths. Just as vehemently, Pierce Butler of South Carolina responded that a 3/5 representation of slaves was absolutely necessary as security against the possibility that their Negroes may not be taken from them, which some gentlemen within and without doors have a very good mind to do. When the entire report of Gary's Grand Committee finally came to a vote on July 16th, it still embodied the fundamental proposition that there would be an equality of votes in the second branch. The number of representatives in the lower house was now set at 65, based strictly on population, with a census to be taken every 10 years to provide data for adjustments. It was far from unanimous. In the voting, 5 states were in favor: Connecticut, Delaware, New Jersey, Maryland, and North Carolina. 4 were against: Pennsylvania, Virginia, South Carolina, and Georgia. And the Massachusetts delegation split down the middle. The morning after the vote, the naysaying delegations caucused ominously on their own. No good government could or would be built on the notion of equal state representation, they concluded, even when it was limited to just one of the houses of Congress. And maybe, some of them wondered, maybe they should simply walk out of the convention entirely. The side, comprising the principal states and a majority of the people of America, proposing some new scheme of government to the states. But as Madison recorded in his notes, this was mostly vague conversation, without any specific proposition or agreement. And for now, any determination of what fraction of the slave population, if any, would be used for calculating representation in the future was left unresolved.